I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing Captain C. Harold Clarkson, M.C., formerly the 15th Field Regiment RCA.
Are you going to lead off with a question?
Yep, there okay. We are. We're on. So, Harold, you were in the militia before the war. Would you like to tell us when and where?
Bill.
How you joined?
I was born in Saskatchewan in 1921 and living in Broadview during the 30s. Where the main social event was the non-permanent active militia. We had a reserve battery there, part of the 22nd Brigade. We, of course, held a training night once a week. We received 25 cents an hour. It was great. Believe me, just great. Tremendous social life. Our battery commander was a World War I veteran, Don McNeil. And during the summer, we climbed on the what we called the CPR colony cars, wooden benches, and trooped off to Camp Shiloh and fired both 4.5 howitzers and some French guns from World War I, 75 millimeters.
Oh, really? I'd never heard of that before. Never
Very interesting, those French guns.
Did you have anything in your battery, in your armories, any guns there for winter training?
We had the 75-millimeter gun for winter training during the 30s and prior to the outbreak of World War II. I might say that when World War II broke out, we lost everything we had. It was taken from us for army purposes, and we carried on doing gun drill with benches.
Oh, did you?
And the like of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they took everything for the troops that were going overseas.
Yeah,
train
they took everything for the more active troops and training them.
What did you have as transportation? How did you tow these guns, or did you ever try?
No. They were not mobile. Mm-hmm. No. We did not tow them. When we went to Camp Shiloh, we trained on the equipment that was at Shiloh, which was mobile, motorized equipment. And there, of course, that was all done, pretty well all done by the regular army at Shiloh.
Well, these guns that you had, were they not mobile through general deterioration of the wheels or what?
We used to haul them around the armories by hand and ropes, but we never took them out.
You didn't have any vehicles, I suppose.
We had no vehicles at that time. None required.
Did you ever have to go to the extreme of using civilian vehicles to... As some militia outfits did.
Not at that particular time, although just after the war was declared, we were out on exercises with civilian vehicles. Very interesting.
Things are pretty desperate in the militia before the war.
We had World War. We were actually very well outfitted from World War I equipment. There were scads of that, and never did get those mothball smells out of it. But tremendous uniforms and bandoliers and everything you could imagine, except vehicles and ammunition. And we, to our standards, the outfitting at Shiloh was tremendous. We received what we considered to be the best of everything there. Good accommodation and tents, good food, good equipment, excellent training to those the standards of those days, which were quite low. Our standards of living was low. It was a tremendous experience.
You were 17 or 18 at this time, I take it, were you?
I would say we started off at 16. Then about 17 or 18, Then after that, I went away to university and joined the Canadian Officers Training Corps there. And
was this pre-war?
This was pre-war.
Yeah.
And was there when war was declared. And then put my name in along with other chaps who joined the Canadian Army, the active Canadian Army, and was finally accepted in 1941 into the Canadian Army.
That long, eh?
Yeah. The Canadian Army had a lot of people in my category who had become officer material at during the course of training, and the Army couldn't handle them as such.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So they just told you that...
They had plenty, in other words.
They had plenty. Just told you to sit tight. Anyway.
What did your training consist of as a member of the COTC?
Well, the COTC was basically lectures, Bill.
Yeah.
Very little CO training, if any. Basically lectures.
Did you go away in the summer with them?
No. No. The summer... We didn't train for COT during the summers. We did any training. It was with our militia battery back in Broadway.
What university was it, Harold?
University of Saskatchewan at Saskatoon.
At Saskatoon, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were you taking there?
Engineering. I was studying engineering there. Yeah, I didn't complete it. I went off to war, never did complete it. But they had a very good school of engineering there. Vigorous young university, and they provided a tremendous number of recruits for the armed forces, all levels of the armed forces.
Yes, I was talking to okay, we're back on again, and so you were second year of engineering or something when you were taken?
Yeah, so mm-hmm. I was at my second year of engineering, and when I was accepted in the Canadian Army, they sent me off to Fort Garry Artillery Officers Training School, Fort Garry in Winnipeg.
Oh, yeah.
This is in the University of Manitoba, where we trained there from January to May, at which time they moved us out to Shallow to finish our field training. And there I received my second lieutenancy. At June, the 110th Field Battery of Broadview of the Non-Permanent Active Militia was mobilized into the active Canadian Army, and I was posted to my original battery back in Broadview, where we recruited, formed a battery, did some very basic training in tents in that area, and we're now into 1942, so in August 42, we moved down to Camp Divert, Nova Scotia, along with a battery from Calgary and a battery from Winnipeg, and the regimental headquarters group from British Columbia, mainly Vancouver, to form the 15th Canadian Field Regiment. And we trained in Divert, Nova Scotia, and did field training up in Tracadie, New Brunswick, on the Bay of Chaleur, moved into the Sussex, New Brunswick area, and did a lot of small arms training in the Halifax area. And by August 42, we embarked for England with brand new 25-pounder guns.
Oh, really? Right from...
Right from Canada.
Right from Nova Scotia, where they were built. Yeah. I
believe it was Quebec.
Quebec.
I've forgotten the name of the area in Quebec to build these guns.
Yeah, I know.
But I believe that the 15th Field Regiment were the first Canadian regiment to take their new guns with them.
Yeah, I can believe that.
And they were just beautiful things. Just our pride and joy. As they were all throughout the campaign, you could put a 25-pounder shell through a bathroom window and with the greatest of ease.
Oh, you didn't lose your guns. So many regiments did, of course. They took them to England, or they got them in England. They lost them before they...
Yes. No, we were very fortunate.
Yeah, you had the same one.
We had the same ones. I don't know who we had working on our behalf. We joined the 4th Canadian Armored Division.
Excuse me. You didn't go over as part of that division. You joined it when you in England, didn't you? Or what?
No.
You just were sent over as an individual?
No. We went over as part of the 4th Canadian Armored Division.
Okay.
Yeah. Under Major General Worthington.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Fighting Frank.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And whether it was his influence or whether we just had good fortune, but we managed to maintain and hold on to our guns, mm-hmm. which we had all through the campaign.
So you didn't go to FPs, you were always towed all the time.
Yes, we were always the towed 25-pounder field guns, and...
Tell me, you did all your artillery training in Canada, then at the Burt.
So So we did our artillery training in Canada from a base camp at DeBert and base camp at Sussex, and our actual field firing was done on ranges up near a little village in New Brunswick called Trackety in the Bay of Chaleur, and where we supposedly fired at targets, but mostly sheep.
That must have impressed the local farmers, no way.
Yeah. Actually, we spent a considerable amount of time putting out fires that we started.
Yes, I'll bet you did.
Quite a problem.
Yeah. Okay. And if... Uneventful trip to England?
Yes, very uneventful trip to England in a large convoy in August. Very good, very nice weather, and arrived there under excellent conditions.
What ship did you sail in?
Beautiful Green Island. A very slow-moving tub called the Cameronium.
Oh, really?
Cameronium, which is rather... every morning we'd wake up, and if anybody was lucky enough to have a pair of binoculars, they could find the convoy way off the horizon, madly signaling for us to crank it up and get with it and catch up.
Oh, dear. Was the whole regiment on this one ship?
Yes, we were. No, I'm sorry. Our 110th field battery was up on this one ship, and there were some of the regiment on another ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, where did you land?
So we landed in Glasgow and trained down to the Aldershot area. As a matter of fact, right in Aldershot. And continued our training there, firing at Lark Hill, which is a vast field artillery or vast mm-hmm. artillery training ground.
Did you brought your guns? Did you bring your own vehicles?
Yeah.
And you eventually married up with them in Aldershot when
yeah.
they all arrived.
Yeah, brought her guns, brought her vehicles, married up with
yeah.
them, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, continued on.
And what sort of a life did you have in Aldershot?
So in Aldershot, we had the usual barrack life with
mm-hmm.
training, gun drill on the square, and gun drill out in what they called the common, which was a muddy or dry, as the case may be, small fields in England. And a considerable amount of firing actually on the South Downs, which were hills just above Eastbourne,
mm-hmm.
in that general area there, beautiful area. And very close to camp. It was only a matter of 4 or 5 hours drive to get down there and back, which eased the petrol situation.
Mm-hmm. Did you partake of any major schemes?
Yeah.
Any big... Now, there was the odd time when there was... major foul-ups in the Canadian Army in Britain.
We did some very interesting training in the mountains of Wales, and some very interesting training in our own in the Newcastle area in the Yorkshire Moors, and participated in a couple of large Canadian Army schemes where snafus abounded. But basically, considering the amount of training. Collective training along with other units that we'd had and the regiments, the other regiments that had the infantry and the armor and that, it all came out pretty well.
Mm-hmm. What were your barrack conditions like? Pretty good? Average?
Very
basic.
British Army
mm-hmm.
basic barracks. Coming from the prairies, it was damp and fuel was sparse. And it seemed to be cold and damp all the time, but it was just a change of climate, a change
yeah.
of atmosphere. But the food was basic and good, and the beer was runneth over.
Yeah.
And and life was very pleasant.
Were you getting Canadian rations at that time?
We were getting partial Canadian rations, such as Canadian cheese and Canadian... For special events, you'd get Canadian turkeys and pork and...
Oh, would you? Yeah.
But a lot of English mutton and English bread and pork. Canadian powdered eggs.
Yeah. Probably the British were eating that too, yeah.
Yeah, Canadian cigarettes.
Yeah.
Actually, when you look back on that period and the problem they were having ferrying supplies across the Atlantic, and the number of people who were feeding on that tight little island, we fared very well. No complaints at all.
Mm-hmm.
We might have thought we had.
Yeah. What about you brought your major equipment with you. Mm-hmm. Were you issued anything there? Any new equipment at all while you were in England?
Yes. We were issued, as I recall, we received our old HIP vehicles. They were ram tanks.
Oh, yeah.
With the sewer pipe welded on to avoid the space taken up by the breech block inside the turret. So you'd have more room for artillery, but much to the chagrin of one of my fellow forward observation officers who was shaking down a cobblestone road in Belgium one day, and the sewer pipe fell off. He felt rather embarrassed about it all.
Oh, boy, yeah, yeah. Sort of leaves you feeling pretty naked, doesn't it?
Yeah. Needless to say, he called for Remy in a welding outfit.
Yeah, yeah.
So he could carry on with the war. I can't recall the exact details of what other items we were issued in England, but basically we took everything with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, from time to time, I suppose, receive some extra.
Did your training change in any marked way as far as the artillery was concerned when you became an armored division?
Not basically, because remember we were an armored division whilst in Canada, and our whole emphasis in our early training was fire and movement,
yeah,
rather than digging in and batting off barrages and time programs and that sort of thing, which we really didn't get into until Lark Hill training there. And nor were we trained to do it. It required a tremendous amount of training for the officers to assimilate that particular knowledge.
Yeah.
And the Lark Hill brains that taught us that in England.
You were pretty hot on crash actions, were you? But on the...
We were very mobile. Our whole... Frank Worthington, Major General Worthington, was a mobile man. And his whole emphasis was on mobility. Fire movement, up and at them, and that the feeling he generated throughout, I would assume, the whole division, certainly throughout our field artillery regiment. And it was he generated a tremendous spirit.
Yeah, yeah. One question in regard to training that I would like to put to you, I don't know whether you would run into this or not, but there was a long period before D-Day when you were preparing for it, and the division as a whole didn't exercise as a division for 6 months prior to D-Day. And I suspect this was reflected in action, and I just wondered whether such a thing had ever been put to you before, or you thought about it.
Well, it hadn't been put to us before, but we were not as affected perhaps as much as the infantry or perhaps the armor were, because we had so many technical details in the artillery to get down, communications, gun drill, the barrages, and all the technical artillery work that required training and training and training and consistent training. And if you wanted to keep it up, never had a dull moment. There was always something you should have been doing, and our COs were quite rigid on a training scale.
Yeah. How long before D-Day were your vehicles waterproof and that sort of thing?
D-Day was in June, we were waterproofing late May. Quite late, because
an awful lot of people were involved in that before that phase.
Yes, they were, but you see, our particular division wasn't scheduled to go in on D-Day. We didn't know
true.
It at the time,
yeah.
But we were scheduled to go in on the follow-up.
I heard the comment that the tanks were waterproof, for example, in the 4th Div. I think principally because of the scheduling of the waterproofing, not that they really had to be done that soon. And I've had the comments that they think the armored regiments particularly lost valuable training time because they weren't allowed to
Yeah, the logistics of it.
Yeah.
That's, well, I could see that perhaps, but you see, and we're in a completely different category in the artillery. We could do dry shoot, dry this, dry that. There's so many things that we are continually doing that you couldn't do as well if you were a tank regiment.
Yeah.
You tank regiment, you had to be out roaring around practicing
and
that movement, and this wasn't as nice. So in that respect, the artillery was very fortunate. No, we'd never had a chance to get stale, partially because of the nature of our arms, and partially, I would say, because of our leaders. Mm-hmm. They had an excellent training.
What brigade were you part of? Or?
Well, we were the 15th Field Regiment in the 4th Canadian Armored Division, and Bill, I can't give you a brigade.
There was the 4th Armored Brigade under Booth, and then there was the. What was the 10th under Jefferson, was it? No.
We were involved with the Argyle and the Sutherland Highlanders and the South Alberta Tanks and the Algonquins, and that group. And the brigade escapes me.
I think it must have been Jefferson's and the Infantry Brigade, I think.
I think. Yeah.
Because the BC Regiment was with
Booth.
With Booth.
Yeah,
and I forget who else. But that's,
yeah. Well, we yes, it would have been because we didn't fight. We didn't support the BC Regiment.
No. Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about that a little later on, but
So it was a very very interesting time in England, training wise. You know. And looking back upon it, that tight little island full of troops, I suppose from its history, had a tremendous number of training areas, and it wasn't any larger, perhaps, or much larger than Vancouver Island, so they were, if you could get around the towns, they were quite accessible, and...
it was difficult to maneuver large bodies, though.
Very difficult for a division.
A division, training. For
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You could really train well up to the regimental or battalion level.
Very well.
I gather not much higher than that.
Yeah.
In most cases.
Yeah. Because of the number of commons, the country is full of commons, and of course, pretty well everything was available for armed forces use in that period. Yeah.
Hmm.
And the climate was very favorable. No freezing temperatures and no desert heat. Exceptional climate for training.
Well, you were in England, a couple of years then, before?
We were in England from fall of 42 until July of 44. If you recall, the Normandy campaign, they hit bad weather as soon as they went in after D-Day, so the whole show was sort of set back a few weeks, and we were scheduled to go over a couple of weeks after D-Day, it wasn't until mid-July that we actually landed in France.
Right.
Sitting there huffing and puffing.
I guess training had begun to wind down a bit in preparation for D-Day when George Kitching took command.
Yes, I would say that...
It may not have affected you very much at the time.
No. I would say that by the time General Kitching took command, we were all ready to go.
No, I know he didn't have very long before...
No, I believe that General Kitching came, and we all went. And
well, he had it for a few months, but not very long.
Yeah, but everything was... By that time, everything had been done, everything decided, and it was a little late in the day for any new training methods or this or that to be started.
I think he took command at the beginning of March, somewhere in there, in March, anyway, I forget the date.
Yeah,
and by that time, of course, you were getting ready to move off or go.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly,
final preparations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything specific about the final preparations of a towed artillery regiment?
Not really. The main thing that I recall about it would be the waterproofing and the careful packing of all your gear and equipment. We had. The troop commanders all had these ram tanks, of course, that they had to get waterproofed and the gear stashed up above, and then everything unwaterproofed and the gear put into its normal battle position, and But other and the same with all the vehicles in the regiment. We were a very motorized group, and practically nobody walked. Mm-hmm. In fact, I guess no one walked then. Period.
I suppose by this time you've got rid of a lot of your anti-gas equipment and that sort of thing. You didn't carry it around your shoulder and neck anymore, did you, by this point?
Strange you mentioned that. I cannot recall gas masks at that stage.
No, that's why I was asking.
Yeah. I can't.
I don't know the date that...
Bill, I can't tell you whether we turned them in or got rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Dropped them in the channel. Drop. What about...
As I recall, the excitement of getting ready for D-Day, basically to make sure that you just had everything down pat, that your training was completed, you knew your job, your troop knew their job, you knew exactly what to do under all conditions and problems that you thought might be thrown at you.
Were you a troop leader at this time?
At that time, I was the troop... No, I'm sorry. At that time, I was the gun position officer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. During my training in England, I went on a gun position officer's course and a troop commander's course.
For the record, would you like to explain what a GPO does?
Well, basically, in an artillery troop, you have a troop commander who, in the field, is up actually directing the fire of his troop. And he's issuing his orders back to the gun position officer, whose basic job was to sight in those guns and to receive all of the orders from his troop commander and produce. If the troop commander wanted to shell up the creek, it's the gun position officer's job, gun position officer's job, to put it there. If the troop commander calls for defense of fire on a laid out plan, it's the gun positions officer to ensure that this happens. So basically, his troop leader leads in the guns for him. He sights them and aligns them and prepares them for action. And then his job is to produce that, see that that action is produced all throughout that particular shoot. And then his job, is, when they're ordered to move on, is to issue the necessary orders and have the guns led off by his troop leader while he goes on and fights up another gun position to wherever he's directed to. So he's the operations officer. The Navy would call him the operations officer.
Right.
The artillery calls him the gun position officer. He has a very responsible job. Whereas the troop commander, who then becomes a forward observation officer, is perhaps up ducking a few things. He has a most venturesome and exhilarating job. The gun position job is blood, sweat, and tears, if I may use
that. Yeah, I expect so, yeah. I'm seeing others do the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many guns in a troop?
Four. We have four guns in the troop. Mm-hmm.
And how many vehicles?
Two troops in the battery. Mm-hmm. And three batteries in a field regiment.
Yeah. Okay. When you were preparing to go overseas or go to Normandy, was extra ammunition carried, extra stores, because you would have to live off your own supplies for a while? What was the...
Very little extras carried with us, because the Army followed up behind us with its Army Service Corps
repair
people and all that. And they were the people that were actually carrying all the...
By the time you got there, dumps had already been established.
That's correct.
In Normandy.
Yeah. Now, I can't answer, for instance, for the artillery that would have gone over on D-Day. I would assume they would have carried some extras.
They did, indeed.
Yeah.
They were pretty nervous about it, somebody told me, because the whole thing just blew up and nothing flat, and they were kind of twitchy about this.
About it, yeah. But with us, as you say, the dumps were established. In fact, we are absolutely astounded to arrive there by mid-July and see the mass of material. Tremendous job that was done by those.
Did you come in over the Mulberry Harbor?
Yeah. Under very calm conditions, I might say. It was almost like climbing on a... well, there were some fireworks going on in the sky of various sorts, but other than that, it was just like a dull cruise.
Did you board by LCT or something like that?
We boarded right at Tilbury, right off, walked on the dock at Tilbury in England, and then went off on the...
No, what sort of a vessel, I mean, did you come over on?
I can't remember. It was just a... it was a ship. I'm sorry. They picked the tank and the vehicles up in the crane and dropped them in the hold.
Oh,
picked
the
guns up.
Regular freighter. Landing craft.
No. And then they came along side and the other end and just reversed the whole process and dropped them on these ferries and off you went at the right tide level. Yeah. When they're at the right.
You were offloaded then at out anchored out somewhere.
Yeah.
You went on these ferries.
Yeah. And offloaded on to the shores of France at the right tide and this. And went up into your encampment, and of course the first job was to get all the waterproofing off and get ready for whatever they wanted you to do. And that didn't take long. Believe me, we were young and vigorous and well fed, and boy, we...
It came off a lot quicker than it went on.
Yeah.
And how long were you there before you went into action?
So we were there, I can't really give you a definite period, but just a couple of days, I would say, and then they moved us up and moved us into the line, so as to say, and told us to set up positions, set up an old pip, and start feeling things out. We took over
now,
from...
Before you go on, would you explain what an old pip is?
Oh, okay. An observation post.
Yeah.
Right. An old pip is an observation post that the forward artillery... forward observation officer uses. It's his position that may be up a tree or behind a hill or whatever, but he has to have a view of the area that he's going to bring fire down on, and that's what an OPIP is. Mm-hmm. The object being to see but not be seen.
Right, yeah. But you'd practice, I suppose, at great length.
Yeah. So while I personally went over as a gun position officer, it was at this stage, the day we moved off into action, I was promoted to become a forward observation officer, to become the troop commander.
You were troop commander then,
So
yeah.
Now I'm a troop commander, so my thinking has to change in an hour and assimilate the new thoughts and job, and the way you go off with the people whom you're supporting. One particular campaign, you may be supporting the infantry. Another one, the armor. And many occasions, both. The infantry would be riding on the tanks or walking behind the tanks, and you'd be dealing with both regiments. My job then, from then on, became very, very simple. When the regiment whom I was supporting called for artillery fire, it was my job to put it where they wanted it, when they wanted it. As simple as that. So, as I said, the main...
You were actually up with one of the forward companies.
So, I would go up with the forward platoon, squadron, company, or what have you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, well, you were not then, or were you, involved in sort of the overall... picture. You have an appreciation of the overall picture on such schemes as totalized or tractable, and when you got on further.
Well, our appreciation would come in this form: is that we'd we would be called back for our rendezvous and our explanation of what we were about to do and our orders issued, and then they would explain the particular battle that was it. That's about to take place and what was supposed to take place and who we were going to support and where we would meet the, say we're going to support the SARs, okay? We'd meet them at such and such.
What's the SAR?
South Alberta Regiment.
Okay,
which were the infantry. We would meet them at such and such a point at such and such a time, and carry on. And that's the way we are filled in the total picture. Then, from then on, the how the battle was developing, would we would learn it from the regiment with whom we were supporting. Mm-hmm. We learned it from them. And good, bad, or indifferent.
Did you, were you involved in these, or did these very heavy concentrations of dust that were thrown up by the armored vehicles moving forward from time to time, is that
well,
troubled you in any degree?
It did trouble my regiment from time to time, very much, yeah, but it didn't trouble me personally very much, because remember, on most occasions, we were up front, the lead vehicle.
Oh, yes, you weren't getting all of that.
And we weren't getting all of that. There was the odd occasion where we seemed to move off like the Roman legions must have at one time. the odd place in Normandy where the enemy had absolutely no air at all to attack you with. And very odd morning, we would just move off a mass of armored vehicles and infantry, and the dust would be unbelievable. But that wouldn't last long with me, because pretty soon I'd be out front with either the infantry or the armor and giving the dust to somebody else.
Did you ever run into any problems with the Air Force?
Yes, on a couple occasions.
Of course,
we,
you know,
we
the
ran
division
in.
Did in total, but I wonder whether you did, actually.
Yeah. Their favorite trick, of course, and they did a very good job of it, was to, if they saw an armored column wheeling along the road, they'd pick off the lead vehicle, and then the rear vehicle, get the whole thing stopped, and then pick off the center ones one by one.
These are typhoons you're talking about now.
Yeah, these were hurricanes or Spitfires or typhoons or what have you. And we had a couple occasions where they did it, but I don't know where they came from, but the tank people had some Canadian flags. Mm-hmm. And had a fantastic system of, as soon as an Allied airplane would appear, they will somebody be whipping out the flag on the ground and sort of shooing them away. I was never with anybody that had any direct casualties from them.
You weren't the subject of the RAF or the RCAF bombing of the general of the 4th Div or the...
I was very fortunate in that respect.
The
6th
Bomber Group, you know, really...
The Calgary, the 95th Battery from Calgary were bombed by the RAF. They were very close to our gun position. And the Americans bombed the daylights out of the Polish division, who were just over on our right, and we stood there in absolute wonderment and thought, well, how come the Jerrys have broken through that far back, you know, back behind us? I say, what's going on over there? Maybe we should be pointing our guns in a different direction, and then we realized what it was. But personally, I was very fortunate. I never...
Yeah, you were lucky, because there was a lot of damage done.
A lot of damage,
extraordinary thing. You know, there was no communication between the ground and the air at that time.
It is unbelievable.
It came along fast after that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't take many mistakes like that to...
See, even the little artillery spotter planes were sent up immediately to try and... But you can imagine these masses of bombers over, and there's so much dust and smoke they're raising, they can't see what's going on anyways after a few drops, so that it takes quite a bit to get them moved off.
Yeah, well, I just couldn't... it apparently played havoc with 4 Div's communications network.
I wasn't a party to that, Bill,
really,
but I can imagine that it would play havoc. But
it knocked the crystals off the sets, and that's even if they weren't anywhere near these enormous bombs.
Well,
you know, just the whole nets were gone. You know,
you know, those American heavies came over, the whole ground just shook.
Yeah.
Everything shook. It's unbelievable, the havoc they caused. But yours truly was very lucky. He was just watching us, but not involved in it.
Yes, you were then. You were, this sort of, I know that this thoroughly disrupted the tactical headquarters of the division, and many of the regimental headquarters as well.
Yeah.
And it's pretty disconcerting.
Yeah.
To be bombed that way.
Strange part about our, my particular job, so many times we were seemed to be strung way out front, dodging this little thing and dodging that little thing, and yet those two catastrophes that you speak of, because we were out there, we missed them.
Yeah.
Or they missed us.
They missed you, yeah. Right. Yeah, we were far enough. You were lucky. And I presume they were between you and your guns, too.
Yeah, that's right.
And your guns were safe on the other side of it.
Yeah. Wonderful thing.
So you were supporting the South Calgary, or you say
South Alberta Regiment, and they were the Calgary Tank people, South Alberta Regiment, and the Argyle and Sutherland Highlanders. They were the infantry people, and the odd time I got involved with the Algonquin Regiment, the tank people, but not very often. They basically and wisely kept one troop or one battery with supporting the same group, because you got to work
you
with
got
each
to know
other.
Them, yeah.
You got to know each other and know this intricacy and that intricacy. You know, you're not in battle very long with a commander before you get to know his thinking.
Yeah,
and
right.
And you can almost predict his moves, and he would be the same with you. He'd soon get to know, well, that artilleryman, I know if I ask him to do this, he'll do that, or no, I can't ask him to do this. He's not going to come up with that. So it eases the situation.
I think the Algonquins were, or at least a couple of companies of them, were involved with that schmozzle with the BC Regiment when they got lost.
Yes, they were. Yes, that's correct. When they got lost
and took
a
hell of a shellacking.
Yeah.
But you weren't involved in that.
I was not involved in that. No. I heard of that at the time. But
I wondered, because of course the BCRs asked for artillery fire.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't see any of it, and then they eventually they got a whole regimental shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't even see that, so they knew they were lost.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, but that wasn't to do with you.
That is a bit disconcerting, but that's one sure way of knowing that you're lost, boy.
Yeah.
When you,
that's right.
Mind you, there's the odd artilleryman, yours truly included, that's called down for some rounds of gunfire and can't see. They just haven't appeared in the right place,
yeah.
And then he knows that he's not mapping.
He's lost.
Very crazy. Yeah.
Well, you were firing, or you were using French maps, I understand.
Yeah. That,
which are not too sporty.
Not too
good.
No. No.
I'd
but
heard
you
that,
see, it didn't really bother us that much in this sense that we'd have to range in anyway. You'd say, okay, you'd pick that point in the map and say, there's that hill over there, and then you could read your map and judge your range and all the rest of it. Well, then you bring down your first round, and if you lost it completely and lost it, maybe three or four more, you start pumping a little smoke around, and then correct your situation.
Correct from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
what color smoke were you using?
You know, that's an interesting question. I'm trying to remember. What
is it
color
yellow?
Smoke were you using? No, I don't think so.
No.
I isn't that interesting? I actually brought down a smoke chute to cover the withdrawal of the infantry one afternoon, and was very pleased at the results. When they came out, they said, well, you never hit one of us, so, you know, you've got to drop that stuff pretty close. And I think it was just black smoke, Bill. I'm sure it was just black smoke.
Well,
I think the what you're referring to are the signals. They have signal smoke shells.
Because this is one of the problems, and I don't know whether you are aware, that the Air Force had, and one of the reasons why they bombed mistakenly, because the Air Force color for indicating a target was yellow.
Mm-hmm. Well.
And our troops on the ground were using yellow smoke at one time.
Ah.
And this was a confusing factor for the Air Force.
Well, you could be right, but I personally
was
not firing yellow smoke shells,
yeah.
Because that just doesn't seem logical to me, because... Well,
yeah.
If I'm gonna try and hide some troops, I don't think I'd want to pl- plunk a bunch of yellow around them.
You know. Well, I don't know. Presumably they're pretty dense, so I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, but, no, no, I just threw that in and see what you'd come up with. So you were, as you gradually worked through your, were you involved in the Totalize, the, that particular operation?
In
Normandy.
In Normandy.
When the
yes, well, as we worked, as we landed in Normandy and worked through there, we took over
the name of these things.
I think some of the names escaped me, but
yeah.
But we took over from the Desert Rats in the Normandy in the Carmel, the Borgovis area, and then got our feet.
Oh, was that the 7th Armored Division?
Yeah.
They would come from Italy then to join the thing. I see.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We took over their position, and they then joined, formed the British First Army, I guess. They would go in with the British First Army. And we were the, 2nd Canadian Army, with General Creerer under General Montgomery. Then we wet our feet at.
But you were
basically
second,
on.
Second
the,
Corps.
We were Second Corps, yeah. We basically wet our feet on the way in the general direction of Falaise, Caen, Falaise, and Trun,
yes.
In that that area there. So my total involvement was in that direction, and basically supporting the infantry and the armor on various occasions and in various tasks. And I believe your Totalize was the break. When the Americans broke out from St. Lo, and the Second Canadian Army was sort of putting pressure on the Germans so that they wouldn't put all their forces over to stop the Americans, then they suddenly decided that they'd direct all their efforts towards Falaise and try and close the Falaise gap, and I believe that Totalize. I think that's where that word came in. Totalize.
Okay. Were you at any operations under this artificial moonlight?
No.
You didn't do anything with that.
I didn't do anything with that artificial moonlight. No. No, but we were on the go all day long, and we just battened down the hatches at night and set up defensive fire positions and. Up and down and at it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. As you were approaching Falaise in that push,
mm-hmm.
trying to get, into Trun, what were you up to then?
Well, basically,
who were you with, or what were you?
The Argyle and Southern Highlanders, and the South Albertas, mostly in the South Albertas in that event. We were just. When I was supporting the tanks, I'd be in the RAM tank vehicle. When I was with the infantry, I'd be generally in the jeep, and a lot of the time on foot, depending on what the situation was. If you're actually advancing through the hedgerows and fields with them, you were on foot with them, and your signaler was with you, so you could relay orders to the guns. He was carrying a radio set.
What sort of radio set was he carrying?
I forget the name of it now, but he'd have it on his back. We actually did very little walking, as little as possible, but as I said, it's the odd time when you just had to, and in the Falaise area, you were just continuing that particular job, going along with them, bringing down. Every time they got stopped by something, they'd want some artillery fire. They weren't about to commit themselves, they didn't have to, without seeing if the guns could flush them out. And one of the beauties of the 25-pounder was that while it wasn't an immense, didn't lobby an immense shell, it was very accurate, and you could very quickly pinpoint a target, and providing it wasn't encased in reinforced concrete, flush it out, eliminate it, and on you'd go. So, and at very rapid, and as soon as you ran out of range, the guns were so mobile, they again could very quickly pick up position and move forward.